Imagine walking into a psychiatrist's office, like back in the late 1990s, and telling them that the future of depression treatment wasn't going to be some shiny new daily pill.
Right, yeah.
Imagine telling them that, you know, in a few decades, the entire medical world would be obsessing over a 1960s battlefield anesthetic and the active compound found in magic mushrooms.
They'd think you were out of your mind.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They probably would have laughed you right out of the room, or maybe even called security.
Mm-hmm.
But here we are. It's 2026, and that is exactly the reality we are living in right now.
It really is a profound shift. I mean, for the vast majority of the 20th century, the whole story of depression was told in a single language, and that was serotonin.
Right. The classic chemical imbalance theory.
Exactly. The prevailing narrative was just that you had this chemical imbalance, like a deficit, and so you took a daily pill, usually an SSRI, to, you know, gently nudge those chemicals back into place, because we love simple linear stories in medicine.
But for sure.
You know, you have a headache, you take aspirin, you have low serotonin, you take an antidepressant.
But the problem for millions of patients, of course, is that that tidy little narrative didn't actually work for everyone.
No, it didn't.
Anyone listening to this who has navigated severe depression, or, you know, watched a loved one go through it, you know, the grueling cycle, trying a medication, waiting 6 weeks, feeling absolutely nothing, and then having to just start all over again.
It's exhausting for patients.
It really is. The psychiatric landscape has been desperate for a new plot line. And our mission for this deep dive is to explore the two very old, very different molecules that basically broke that plot wide open. We're talking about ketamine and psilocybin.
Two fascinating compounds.
We are pulling from a remarkably comprehensive 2026 clinical and neuroscientific breakdown published in the OATW Journal today. And our goal is to figure out exactly how these rapid-acting treatments actually rewire a depressed brain, what they demand of you as a patient, and where the science actually stands today.
Well, before we look at the brain scans and the clinical trials, we really need to set the parameters for this conversation.
Okay, let's do it.
Because the natural instinct, when you have two highly publicized treatments like this, is to pit them against each other, right? To try to crown a winner.
Right, like ketamine versus psilocybin.
Exactly. But treating them as competitors really misses the biological reality. What the OTW Journal makes super clear is that this is a study in contrast. You have to picture these two molecules as entirely distinct doorways.
Just doorways, okay.
Yeah, so they look different, they open differently, but they just happen to open into the exact same wounded neural system in the brain.
I want to spend some time on those doorways, actually, because to understand how these drugs change your life as a patient, I think we first have to understand the mechanics of how they change your brain.
Definitely.
The text starts with ketamine. So how does a literal battlefield anesthetic actually work on depression?
So mechanically, ketamine is an NMDA receptor antagonist, and the prevailing model for why it works in depression is something called the disinhibition hypothesis. What happens is that ketamine selectively blocks these NMDA receptors on inhibitory GABA interneurons.
Whoa. Okay, wait. Let me stop you right there.
Too much.
You just threw like a whole dictionary of neuroscience at me. NMDA antagonists, GABA interneurons. Break that down for someone who didn't go to medical school. What is actually happening in the brain?
Fair enough. Let's simplify it. Think of your brain's neural activity as a car.
A car. Got it.
You have an accelerator, which drives activity, and you have brakes, which, you know, slow things down. Those inhibitory GABA interneurons I just mentioned, those are the brakes.
Okay.
So ketamine comes in and it specifically blocks the receptors on the brakes.
So it's basically cutting the brake lines.
Precisely. It cuts the brakes. And when you remove the brakes from a highly complex system like the human brain, the immediate result is a sudden, highly targeted surge of a different neurotransmitter called glutamate.
And where does that happen?
Primarily in the prefrontal cortex. This glutamate surge is powerful. It slams into a second class of receptors called AMPA receptors. And that massive activation of AMPA, that is the critical domino falling, it sets the entire antidepressant effect into motion.
Okay, that actually makes sense. So ketamine cuts the brakes, which triggers a localized flood of glutamate to just jumpstart the prefrontal cortex.
Right.
That's the first door. Now, the journal contrasts this with the second door, psilocybin.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm assuming magic mushrooms aren't doing the same thing to the brake lines.
No, they are arriving from the exact opposite direction, actually. When you ingest psilocybin, your body metabolizes it into its active form, which is psilocin.
Okay.
And instead of blocking a receptor like ketamine does, psilocin stimulates one. It is a 5-HT2A serotonin receptor agonist. And these specific serotonin receptors are heavily concentrated in the outer layers of the brain, so the cortex.
Wait, so we are back to serotonin. I thought the whole point was we were moving past the old SSRI model.
We are. Because it's a completely different mechanism of action on the serotonin system.
How so?
Well, SSRIs try to slowly increase the background hum of serotonin over, like, weeks or months. Psilocybin aggressively targets this one specific 5-HT2A receptor, causing a massive immediate increase in cortical excitability.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. When researchers look at neuroimaging of a brain on psilocybin, they see an explosion of what they call neural entropy.
Neural entropy. Mm-hmm. Now, entropy usually means like chaos or disorder, right?
Yes.
Why is a chaotic brain a good thing for someone dealing with depression?
Because a depressed brain is often way too ordered. It's rigid.
Oh, interesting.
Think about the physical sensation of depression. It's also characterized by being totally trapped in intense self-referential rumination. You know, you are stuck in a loop of negative thoughts about yourself.
Yeah, that relentless negative loop.
Exactly. And neurologically, that loop is governed by something called the default mode network.
The default mode network. I hear that term thrown around a lot in like mindfulness and meditation circles. What is it? Medically speaking,
it's essentially the brain circuit that handles your internal monologue. It's active when you are daydreaming or reflecting on the past or, you know, worrying about the future.
Okay.
In severely depressed patients, imaging actually shows the default mode network is hypoconnected.
What would that look like?
It's like a sled track in the snow that has been run over so many times that the grooves are impossibly deep.
Oh, I see.
You just can't steer out of them. But psilocybin creates entropy, which temporarily dissolves that rigid network. It essentially flattens the sled track.
Wow.
Suddenly, different parts of the brain that haven't communicated in years start talking to each other again.
That is a wild contrast.
Yeah.
So if I'm hearing this right, ketamine is this targeted electrical glutamate surge that forces the system to jumpstart.
Yep.
Meanwhile, psilocybin is an entropy generator that temporarily melts down the brain's rigid highways so new ones can be built.
That's a great way to put it.
But they couldn't sound more different. And you said earlier they open into the exact same room.
Yeah.
How does cutting the brakes and melting the highways achieve the same goal?
This is the discovery that has the whole neuroscience community so captivated right now. This is the big aha moment in the journal.
Lay it on me.
Despite having completely different starting points, both the AMPA activation from ketamine and the 5-HT2A activation from psilocybin trigger the exact same downstream biological cascade.
Really?
Yeah. It's a signaling pathway known as BDNF-TRKB-MTOR.
Okay, I am going to need you to unpack another acronym salad for me.
Mm.
What is BDNF?
My apologies. So BDNF stands for brain-derived neurotrophic factor. The absolute easiest way to conceptualize it is as Miracle-Gro for your brain cells.
Miracle-Gro. Okay, I like that.
It is the absolute core of the brain's neuroplasticity machinery.
So by plasticity, you mean the brain's ability to physically change and adapt.
Yes, exactly. When depression ravages the brain, neurons in the prefrontal cortex literally shrivel.
They physically shrink.
They do. They lose their branches, which are called dendritic spines. And that means they lose the ability to connect and communicate with other neurons.
That's terrifying.
It is. But whether you use the ketamine jolt or the psilocybin network flattening, the end result is this massive release of BDNF. This forces those neurons to rapidly sprout new dendritic spines.
Wow.
You are quite literally regrowing the brain's lost connections.
And the 2026 data in this journal highlights just how aggressive this regrowth really is, because there's a 2023 study referenced here that genuinely just stopped me in my tracks.
Right, the affinity study, right?
Yeah. It found that psychedelics bind to the receptor for BDNF, the TRKB receptor, with roughly 1,000-fold higher affinity than traditional classical antidepressants.
1,000-fold. It's just staggering. They're basically hotwiring the brain's natural ability to heal itself.
That's incredible.
But this brings us to the biggest practical reality for you as a patient. Because they flip this plasticity switch using completely different chemical pathways, the timeline of how they affect the human body is vastly different. The journal frames this as a biological trade-off. We can think of it as the tortoise and the hare.
The hare, without a doubt, is ketamine. And when we talk about the speed of ketamine, we really need to contextualize what it feels like. The source highlights a landmark 2006 trial by Carlos Arrate.
A very famous trial.
Right. And according to the data, patients with severe treatment-resistant depression can begin to feel the fog lifting in about 110 minutes after a ketamine infusion.
110 minutes. That completely shattered the existing paradigm of psychiatry.
It's hard to even wrap your head around that.
It is, because before ketamine, if a patient presented in an emergency room with acute suicidality, a doctor's only real pharmacological tool was a pill that might take 4 to 6 weeks to work.
And when you're in a crisis, 6 weeks is an absolute eternity.
Exactly. Ketamine acts as an immediate rescue intervention. You can walk into a clinic carrying the unbearable weight of severe depression and literally walk out 2 hours later feeling a tangible biological distance from your despair.
So the hare is incredibly fast.
Extremely fast.
Which naturally leads to the tortoise, psilocybin. The antidepressant benefit of a 25 milligram dose of psilocybin does not happen in 2 hours.
No, definitely not.
For those 2 hours, you aren't feeling relief. You are deep inside a profound and honestly often very difficult psychedelic state.
Right.
The actual lifting of the depression unfolds over the days and weeks following the session. So the obvious question for a patient looking at this is, why would anyone choose the tortoise?
That's a fair question.
Right. Like, if you can get relief in under 2 hours with ketamine, why endure an intense day-long psychological journey that takes weeks to fully integrate?
Because of the single biggest drawback to ketamine, which is the durability trade-off. The hare might win the sprint, but it really struggles with the marathon.
Not so.
Ketamine's rapid relief is famously transient. For most patients, a single infusion begins to lose its effect within 1 to 2 weeks.
Oh, wow. So you're pulled out of the fire, but you basically get dropped right back in a week later.
That's the huge risk. To keep the depression at bay, ketamine usually demands a burdensome, open-ended commitment to maintenance dosing.
Like going back continuously.
Yeah, a patient might find themselves needing to go to a clinic every week or every other week, indefinitely. It becomes a permanent biological upkeep.
That sounds exhausting.
It is. Psilocybin, on the other hand, functions as a discrete intervention. The clinical trials show that the plasticity triggered by just 1 or 2 sessions of psilocybin can hold the depression back for weeks, month, or in some groups, up to a full year.
A year of relief from just 1 or 2 sessions.
Yes.
That completely alters the rhythm of a patient's life. You are choosing between a standing prescription that you have to constantly maintain versus a deep, singular intervention that you might revisit only once a year.
Exactly.
And that difference in how they are administered explains why they look so different on the regulatory scoreboard today in 2026.
Yeah, the clinical scoreboard is where the rubber really meets the road. Ketamine is already deeply entrenched in the medical system. Esketamine, which is the patentable nasal spray version sold under the brand name Spravato, was FDA approved back in 2019 as an add-on treatment.
Right.
But the source notes a major update. As of January 2025, the FDA approved Spravato as a standalone monotherapy for treatment-resistant depression.
Standalone meaning what exactly?
That means doctors can prescribe it as the first line of defense without making you take a traditional SSRI alongside it. And generic racemic ketamine is also widely used off-label via IV.
Okay, I see the term FDA-approved standalone monotherapy, and I kind of have to push back a bit.
Okay, go ahead.
Because we are so conditioned to hear FDA approved and just assume it means a pharmaceutical miracle, does this data actually show that ketamine is a magic bullet?
It does not, and that is a crucial asterisk to highlight here. A massive 2024 meta-analysis looking at esketamine found that its pooled effect size is quite modest.
How modest?
It falls somewhere between 0.15 and 0.23.
Stop right there. An effect size of 0.23. What does that actually mean for the human being taking the drug?
In statistics, an effect size of 0.2 is generally considered small.
Okay.
It means that while the drug is definitely performing better than a placebo across a massive group of people, the actual magnitude of the relief for the average individual might be subtle.
Subtle like how?
It might be the difference between feeling completely paralyzed by depression versus just having enough energy to get out of bed and take a shower. It's an improvement, absolutely, but it's not universally transformative for everyone.
And the journal also points out a fierce debate over how these trials are even conducted, right? The functional unblinding issue.
Yes, this is a huge topic. In a gold standard clinical trial, you have a drug group and a placebo group, and nobody's supposed to know which they're in.
Obviously.
But the problem with ketamine is that it induces dissociation.
Right. It's pretty hard to convince a patient they received a sugar pill when they feel like they're literally floating outside of their own body.
Exactly. When patients know they got the active drug, their expectation of getting better skyrockets, which artificially inflates the perceived effectiveness of the drug.
And the placebo effect is strong.
The placebo effect is incredibly powerful in depression. So the reality of ketamine is that it is highly established and accessible, but the clinical efficacy is nuanced. Now, let's look at psilocybin's data, which has just been rapidly ascending.
But to be clear, as of mid-2026, psilocybin is still investigational, right? The FDA hasn't approved it yet.
Not yet, but the data is knocking very loudly on the FDA's door.
Let's hear it.
The journal details Compass Pathways' massive Phase 3 trials in 2025, which were known as 2MP005 and CUMP006. They were testing a synthetic formulation of psilocybin for treatment-resistant depression.
And what were the results?
A single 25-milligram dose showed response rates around 37% and remission rates near 29% at the 3-week mark.
Wait, for a treatment-resistant population?
Yes.
Meaning these are people who have failed multiple other medications, having nearly a third of them hit full remission after one session, is huge.
It is huge. And the durability signals are even more striking in specialized populations. In trials looking at patients facing end-of-life cancer distress, a single psilocybin session has yielded clinician-rated response rates of nearly 80%.
80%.
And holding strong 6 months out.
Wow. But, you know, focusing purely on the efficacy in the FDA pipeline kind of ignores the elephant in the room.
The safety profile.
Right. The way these drugs act in the body brings incredibly different safety hazards to the table. And as the source material makes super clear, the hazards don't just differ in degree, they differ completely in kind.
That is a vital distinction to make. You can't just categorize one as the safe one and the other as the dangerous one. You have to look at what they actually do to the body over time.
Right.
Let's start with ketamine. Because ketamine is generally utilized as a chronic maintenance treatment, its physical risks accumulate over time.
What kind of physical risks are we talking about?
Well, first, it is a Schedule 3 controlled substance with genuine dependence and abuse liability.
Because it's a recreational drug, too.
Exactly. It activates reward pathways. Physiologically, it causes transient spikes in blood pressure during the infusion. But the most alarming hazard with heavy, long-term use is a condition called ketamine-induced ulcerative cystitis.
Cystitis? Wait, that's bladder toxicity, right?
Yes. Heavy exposure to ketamine can be profoundly toxic to the bladder lining.
Oh, man.
It causes severe pain, urinary frequency, and in the worst cases, irreversible structural damage to the bladder.
Irreversible?
Irreversible. If you are a patient looking at a timeline of years of ketamine maintenance, that cumulative physical toll absolutely has to be part of your calculation.
That is a very heavy physical cost. What is the cost of psilocybin then? I assume it isn't destroying your bladder.
It isn't, no. Psilocybin is physiologically very well tolerated and is not considered addictive at all. The risks of psilocybin are almost entirely concentrated in the acute session itself, and they are psychological, not physical.
Ah, the infamous bad trip.
Exactly. The signature risk is navigating a period of overwhelming anxiety, existential dread, or panic during the peak of the drug's effect.
Which can be intense.
In a supervised clinical setting, trained facilitators can guide a patient through that safely. But if done recklessly, it can be deeply destabilizing. And beyond the acute distress, there are strict medical boundaries for who can actually take this drug.
The journal explicitly lists out who is contraindicated, right?
Yes, it does. A personal or family history of psychosis, schizophrenia, or bipolar disorder is a firm red line.
Why is that?
Psychedelics can precipitate prolonged psychotic breaks or severe manic episodes in vulnerable individuals. The data in the journal actually cites a survey of users with bipolar disorder, where roughly one-third reported their symptoms significantly worsened after taking a psychedelic.
One-third, wow. Oh, and I also read something about a theoretical heart valve risk.
Ah, yes, the 5-HTTB risk. There is a theoretical risk for heart valve issues with chronic microdosing, but hasn't really been established for occasional therapeutic macrodoses.
Okay, so to summarize the risk profiles, ketamine carries this creeping cumulative physical toll, kind of akin to a repetitive stress injury over time.
Right.
Whereas psilocybin is a singular intense psychological storm, which means the environment where you take these drugs has to be entirely different. If the psychological risk of psilocybin is that high, you obviously can't just swallow a pill and drive to work. What does taking this actually look like?
The setting is the defining difference in the patient experience here. Ketamine requires a fairly basic medical ritual.
Like a normal doctor's visit.
Basically, you need a comfortable infusion chair, a blood pressure cuff, and a quiet space to ride out a 45-minute dissociative interval. It operates very much like a standard outpatient medical procedure.
You go in, get your dose, wait an hour, and just take an Uber home.
Yes, exactly. The psilocybin paradigm is vastly more demanding.
I would imagine.
The clinical trials are structured around a highly curated, full-day supervised session. You don't just show up and take the drug.
What do you do?
You undergo hours of psychological preparation beforehand. During the actual dirking session, you wear eye shades, you listen to a meticulously selected music playlist, and two trained facilitators sit in the room with you for 6 to 8 hours.
6 to 8 hours. So is the drug doing the work or is the therapy doing the work?
The current consensus is that they are inseparable. And the most critical component actually happens in the days following the dose.
What's that?
It's called psychological integration. Therapists help you unpack the imagery, the emotions, and the insights from the trip, basically helping you translate a chaotic neurological event into actual lasting changes in your daily behavior.
When you lay out the intense requirements of that setting, it immediately brings up the question of access. Like, who actually has the time, the money, and the legal right to access these treatments in 2026?
The 2026 access landscape is completely asymmetrical. Ketamine, because it is an approved medical product, is highly accessible. You can find specialized infusion clinics in almost every major city.
Right.
But the real explosion in access came from at-home telehealth platforms.
Telehealth. Wait, you can get ketamine mailed to your house.
Yes. During the early 2020s, federal flexibilities allowed doctors to prescribe controlled substances without an in-person visit. And the journal notes that in January 2026, the DEA and HHS extended those telehealth flexibilities through the end of the year.
Wow, okay.
So, companies are prescribing oral ketamine lozenges for at-home use after just a brief video consultation.
That seems wild.
Well, it makes the drug incredibly accessible and affordable, but it removes the clinical safety net, raising massive concerns about proper screening and monitoring.
I bet. And what is the legal status of psilocybin right now?
Federally, psilocybin is still a Schedule A illegal substance. The DEA considers it to have no accepted medical use.
Go.
However, a parallel state-level system has rapidly emerged. Oregon has had licensed service centers operating for years. Colorado opened its first licensed healing centers in 2025.
And didn't New Mexico just do something, too?
Yes. The journal highlights that New Mexico passed their Medical Psilocybin Act last year, with their infrastructure aggressively scaling up to accept patients in late 2026.
But to be clear, New Mexico isn't opening, like, retail mushroom dispensaries.
No, absolutely not. These state models are supervised use pathways. You have to consume the substance on site under the supervision of a licensed facilitator. It mimics the clinical trial setting, but it operates entirely outside of the FDA medical system.
So if you are a listener trying to synthesize all this data for yourself or, you know, for someone in your life who is suffering, how do you even begin to make a choice between the two?
You have to look at the specific reality of the patient. If speed is the absolute non-negotiable need, for example, a patient in a severe life-threatening acute crisis ketamine is the pragmatic choice.
Right.
The hair can pull you out of the fire today.
But if you have time.
If you are looking for long-term durability and you have the psychological capacity, the legal access, and the time for a day-long inner journey, psilocybin is increasingly looking like the superior fit.
That makes sense.
The rest of the decision is dictated by medical history. If a patient has a history of substance use disorder, the dependence liability of ketamine makes it a very risky choice. If they have a family history of bipolar disorder or schizophrenia, psilocybin is completely off the table.
What a profound evolution in how we treat the human mind. I mean, we spent decades focusing entirely on a daily serotonin drip. Now, we are looking at two radically different molecules.
It's a whole new world.
One acts as a targeted glutamate surge, severing the brakes on your neural circuitry to jumpstart the system. The other acts as an entropy generator, dissolving the deeply rutted default mode network so your brain can escape its own loops.
Beautifully summarized.
And yet both of these doorways lead to the exact same biological result, flooding the brain with BDNF and forcing neurons to physically grow new connections.
Which brings us to a final thought that I think perfectly encapsulates where the science is heading right now.
What's that?
The researchers at the cutting edge aren't trying to figure out which of these drugs is better. They are asking a much more provocative question. What if the future of psychiatry relies on using them sequentially.
Wait, sequentially? What does that look like in practice?
Imagine a patient arrives in the emergency room in the depths of an acute suicidal crisis. You don't have time for preparation or therapy.
Right, you need action now.
You use ketamine's rapid 2-hour onset as a rescue intervention. You pull them out of immediate danger. You stabilize them.
Okay, and then?
Then a few weeks later, when they are out of the immediate crisis but looking down the barrel of a lifetime of maintenance infusions, you transition them to a guided psilocybin session.
Oh, wow.
You use the deep integrative durability of the psychedelic experience to lock in the neuroplasticity, allowing the healing to last for months or even years.
Wow. Using the hare to win the sprint,
mm-hmm.
and then tagging in the tortoise to finish the marathon.
That is an incredibly hopeful vision for the future of mental health. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the OOTW Journal's breakdown of ketamine and psilocybin. Remember to keep questioning that tidy, linear narrative of the world around you, because as the science of the brain is proving today, sometimes the messy, complicated, and entirely unexpected paths are where the real healing begins. Take care of yourselves, and we'll catch you on the next deep dive.